for those of you who were with us last year at this time, in fact, this series will follow that series. We spent 2 years studying portions of the Tractate Chagiga, which were all about Merkabah mysticism and the notion of mysticism that we have in the Talmud, which is more or less centered there. I have an abiding interest in mysticism, not necessarily in Kabbalah per se, although naturally anyone who's interested in mysticism is interested in Kabbalah. It's not because of the academic study of Kabbalah that I'm drawn into it, but rather because I'm very interested in religious experience. What is the nature of religious thinking? What are the limits of rational thinking? And to what extent do we as Jews either understand or misunderstand the nature of our faith when we are too dependent upon a rational depiction of it? That has been the modern way of looking at Judaism, at religion in general. And I, for one, am a rebel against it. And what I started in the last 2 years in looking at mystical literature in the Talmud itself, I'm actually in my own strange way going to be continuing when we look at mezuzah, at the tefillin, and at the Sefer Torah. I'm going to ask you the question of what is it to understand something, period. What is the nature of understanding? What are the possibilities of understanding? And what are the limits of understanding? This is a little bit of an introduction. I see there are new faces here. Not all of you do I know, period, let alone well. Why don't we just go around the table and introduce yourselves, tell us who you are and anything else you'd like to say when you do that. I am Harlan Wexler. I am the Rabbi Emeritus of Congregation Or Zeruah. Privileged to be back from Jerusalem, where we spend a little more than half the year in more or less 3 month segments. So this is our New York segment, which just began about a week and a half ago. So it's nice to be back.
I'm Barry Kohler, and I'm Bobby's husband.
Often I am introduced as Barry's wife, so that's kind of nice. So I'm Bobby Kohler. We have been longstanding and very appreciative members of the Talmud class at Or Zeruah.
Alan Adel, also a longstanding member of the Talmud group.
Herbert Rubishaw.
Rana Silver. Very happy to be here.
I'm Alan Adel, and I knew the entire Talmud by heart when I was 8, so I'm only here to remember what I heard.
That's wonderful. You managed to keep it in your head till you were 8. Most of us forgot it at birth.
He's here to understand today. He's learned it, now he's got to understand it.
I see. Okay.
All right. Reed Schneider.
Ann Schneider.
Larry Stolman, brother of Robert Barnes, the Shul.
Sally Skolnick, his wife. Leslie Korosoff, good friend.
Rob Skolnick.
Diane Okrent, long-time member of Or Zeruah.
Aaron Sheldon, married to Diane Okrent, and we're long-sitting members.
Jay Palmer, 20 years.
20 years. Go on.
Sharon Campbell, member of the
I'm at Alex Church Connection, started attending last year.
Okay.
And
very faithful.
Yes, very nice. Mona Dreyer.
Laura, I think we're up to you.
Yep. Ivan Eisenblum.
Robert Beller.
Pat Samuel Glenick, the new member.
Okay.
Miriam Wallace.
Harold Parasoff. Marcus Skolnick.
Okay,
good. Arthur Silva.
Eric Weinstein.
Pleasure. So nice to meet you all. To be together again. I've chosen as the text a portion of the Tractate of Menachot. And you are, of course, most welcome to purchase a book, which you can most easily do on the Internet or in a Jewish bookstore. We are reading in the Tractate of Menachot. It is the first, in the Art Scroll edition of Menachot, it is the first of two volumes. And since I don't really know how much material we're going to cover, but since it's only three lectures, even if we went really fast, we wouldn't cover that many pages. And since I have the feeling, given my own predilection toward how to deal with this material, I really want to go slowly and just take off from the ramifications of some of the material, I thought that I would do you a favor and just print up a little bit that you can take with you, and if you want to just stick with that, that's also fine. Okay? In the handout that I gave you, there is a tough page, and we'll be dealing with that shortly. What that page is a photo of a cloth, of a parchment, of a mezuzah. And we'll be looking at that rather carefully in a little while. Now, the subject of mezuzah, tefillin, and Torah is, of course, a very basic subject in classical Judaism. Even in our time, most Jewish homes have a mezuzah on the door. Now, as a rabbi in the community, I get into a lot of apartments. I've probably been in more apartments on Park Avenue than hardly anybody else I know. Just because I lived in the neighborhood as a rabbi for almost 35 years. So, and I always look, of course, to see whether there's a mezuzah on the door. As I do when I wander around my own apartment building. And amazingly, there usually is. There aren't necessarily mezuzot on all the inner doors, because we are, in fact, commanded to place a mezuzah on every door of our home, with the exception of the bathrooms. So it's not necessarily on the inner doors, but mezuzot are widely, widely observed. Tefillin, much less. I've told some of you that I expect one of the great archaeological digs will be done someday in New York Harbor. And they will find 500,000 tefillin that were thrown overboard as the boats passed the Statue of Liberty. They came from Eastern Europe. That was the end of the tefillin. They're down there somewhere. And Sefer Torah, we all know the sacred nature of a Sefer Torah. I think that that is something that Jews have wide connection to. These are three written media. They are all written. They are written in a very precise and prescribed fashion, and they must be written in that fashion, with certain variations depending upon custom. But it is highly prescribed. The area of the Talmud that talks about this subject is found in the Tractate of Menachot. Now, you know, there are many tractates to the Talmud. You can see in the back there we've got a few editions of the Talmud. They run between a minimum of 20 volumes to a maximum of, I don't know how many are in the Art Scroller, probably about 40 or 50. The Talmud is a rather large book. Those of you who are familiar with the study of Talmud know also that the Talmud covers just about every subject that you can imagine, and in addition to that, many that you cannot imagine. The Talmud is like walking into another world. It's a total civilization reading the Talmud, and it is sort of ordered in an order, but I underline the word sort of. The Talmud that you have in these many volumes is really based on an ordered book, which is the Mishnah. The Mishnah, to review again, was edited by Rabbi Judah, the prince in the land of Israel, in Tiberias, at the end of the 2nd century, so roughly about the year 200. Okay? And that was a summary of the law till his time. By summarizing the law till his time, he did two things. One, he told you what a part of that law was. And the other thing that he did was leave out everything else. And you are dealing with a complex civilization here. If you were to take any one publication in our civilization and say that this is telling us what America is and what its civilization is all about, how accurate a picture do you think you would have of American civilization? You would have but one tiny perspective on it. And that, in fact, was the reality when Rabbi Judah the Prince edited the Mishnah. He tried to do something comprehensive, and part of the comprehensive test that he set about doing was that he tried to also include varying opinions. The Mishnah hardly has a page in it that doesn't have an opposite opinion. It is therefore the basic Jewish book. Jews never agree on anything, and the Mishnah never, with very small exceptions, has a page without disagreements. It's a very basic way in which this literature was constructed. It was an oral literature, set down in a written form, but it's essentially an oral literature. And if you've ever been involved in doing things orally, you know that you can move sideways as much as you can move up and down, you can move forward, you can move to the side. When you have an oral conversation, sometimes it ends up in strange places. So the Mishnah does try to comprehensively summarize the varying areas of Jewish law. And to a modern Jew, those areas are also often very distant and things that you wouldn't necessarily think about. For example, a large part of the Mishnah is devoted to sacrificial law. A large part of the Mishnah is devoted to the laws of purity, which give you great details which concern the nature of purity that enables you to enter the temple. Temple in Jerusalem, on Har Habayit, on the Temple Mount. These are not everyday concerns of Jews, and when it finally came to summarize the law some 1,500, almost 1,500 years later, 1,300 years in fact later, almost 1,400 years later, when Rabbi Yosef Karo, in the city of Tzfat, in the land of Israel, decided to write a practical compendium of the law called the Shulchan Aruch, which is the book that you go to if you want to know what the law is, he left out most of the law. Why did he leave it out? Because it wasn't relevant. Laws about sacrifices were not relevant. There was no temple. laws about purity were not relevant. There was no temple. Okay? So the Shulchan Aruch is a very practical book, but left out major piece of the law. The Talmud has it all. Talmud consists of the Mishnah and the Gemara. The Gemara is that part of what was going on in the civilization, sometimes about law and sometimes not about law, that was not included in the Mishnah. Okay? We will see that as we look at some Mishnah, and as we look then at the Gemara. In that section of the Talmud that deals with sacrificial law, the first two tractates are one Zivachim. Zivachim means sacrifices. So there are many, many details. The whole book of Leviticus, for example, is filled with details, particularly the first two parashiyot of Leviticus. Enormous number of details about how to offer sacrifices. Well, if you think that's a lot, you ain't seen nothing yet till you go to Masechet Zivachim. It is, I think, the largest tractate in the entire Talmud. The huge, huge book. Huge. There is so much law of sacrifice. Realize that the Mishnah was written, again, in about 200. The temple was destroyed in the year 70. So there was a great deal of memory, even by then, of what happened, number one. Number two, because there was no temple, and because there was a certain level of memory, there was a tremendous desire to preserve facts. It was no longer a reality, but there were facts that needed to be preserved. We were at that point in Jewish history, and that happens from time to time. I mean, you just look at the modern Jewish world. I remember back well enough, I tell you a story. We were once inviting in college a writer that nobody had ever heard of. But our Hillel director was an Eastern European immigrant, and he knew a lot of Eastern Europeans, some of whom had emigrated to America. And he said, I got a great idea. This guy, you don't know this guy. Nobody knows about him. But he says, he's really terrific. So we said, well, is anybody going to come to the lecture? He said, well, I don't know, but he's really, really good. He said, what's his name? Wiesel. Wiesel. Does he have a first name? Ellie. Ellie Wiesel. So nobody knows who he is. Nobody's going to come to the lecture. So I said, no, he's very good. Then he stops. The rabbi stops. He says, well, I don't know if he speaks English. Called him up and I told him, he says, Ellie, he speaks any Yiddish. He speak English. He says, a little bit. I speak English, yes. So, at that point in time, this is 1962, that's not the Middle Ages. People have not, Americans had not yet begun to read about the Holocaust. There was no Holocaust literature in 1962. After that period of time, roughly about late 60s and 1970, began the first Holocaust literature in English. Didn't exist. I remember trying to teach this, some of this material. There were no books. There were simply no books. A lot has gone on since. There are times in history where you collect things. And the Talmud is an example of the period in history when things were collected about the temple because it was a disaster in Jewish national life, the destruction of the temple. And there was the need to preserve it, and it is preserved in the Talmud. So Zivachim is the first of those sections about sacrifices. The second one is menachot. A mincha is a grain offering. Okay? And if you remember from the book of Leviticus, when animal offerings were brought to the temple, They were brought frequently with accompanying grain offerings. There would be solit, a very pure form of flour, and that flour would be mixed with olive oil, and they would be combined together. A small amount would be removed. It would then be mixed with livona, which was, how do you say livona in English? I think I wrote it down. Frankincense. And then that small amount, which was called a komets. A komets is a fistful, a handful. Okay? A full handful would be taken, mixed with the frankincense, and then placed on the altar. Okay? There would be a lot left over. And that would then be available for the use of the Kohanim. The priestly family would be able to use that flour and that oil after it had been left over, because only a small amount went on the altar. Okay? Now, there were in fact different kinds of grain offerings that were brought. A wide variety of them. As you can see, again, the first two parshiot of Masechet, of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus. And the Talmud, in the chapter that we're going to look at, which is called Akometz Rabbah. Komets, you now know, means a handful. Right? Rabbah, the big handful. The big handful. Deals with an interesting question, which is a sort of a Talmudic issue that comes up. The question is, what if you don't put one of the necessary ingredients into the komets? What happens from that point on? You leave out the olive oil. Could you still fulfill the mitzvah? Okay? What about you start out with flour, okay? You remove some of it, you put in the olive oil, you remove even a smaller amount with the komets, with one handful, and you bring it onto the altar, okay? You find, you forgot, however, to put in the frankincense. That's the last thing that goes in. Okay, so intuitively you would probably say to me, well, if you forgot the frankincense, you can't put it on the altar. How could you put anything on the altar that wasn't really perfect? Intuitively, I think you would feel that way. But how about this? What about the leftover flour, which never has frankincense in it? Could you eat it? Could the Kohanim eat it? Huh? That's not so intuitive. That's an interesting thought question, okay? The question here is, to what extent, in a complex religious experience, do you have to be complete in what you do? All right? Things can be rather complex, and we know this in life in general. Life in general, if you have a dinner party, there are a million things you have to think about. And we like to comfort ourselves with the thought that if you don't do everything, it doesn't matter. It'll still be wonderful. But what if God was coming to dinner? All right? Which is what, in fact, it's the notion here. You've got a temple. You're bringing food to a divine place. Whatever's going to happen to it, it's going to go up in smoke. Right? This was the reality. This is how they function. If it's God's dinner, you better get it right. You better get it right, because that's the nature of this whole thing. Okay? Or not. Maybe not. Maybe God is forgiving. God doesn't really care so much. We're only people. And after all, what difference does it make? Okay, we wouldn't bring it to the altar, but what about the stuff that's left over? It's good food. You're going to throw out the food? These are the kinds of questions that are dealt with in this chapter of the Talmud. Okay? Now, what in the world does that have to do with the mezuzah, tefillin, and Sefer Torah? Okay, that's the question. Well, to put it in legal terms, as the Talmud would discuss it, the question the Talmud is trying to approach is, if you leave out something of a complex group of requirements, does anything disqualify the total activity? Does anything? Does one thing, two things, if you leave out four things? Okay? When you have complex activities and you don't do all of them, all right, are they still okay or are they not okay? Or how okay are they if they're only partly okay? Okay? So, for example, if you look, let me just take a look at one of these. Okay. Look on page 28A2. Okay, you have a Mishnah. Let's look at the Mishnah, and you'll see how this is concretized, these concepts are concretized in the Mishnah. By the way I have this printed up, there is a traditional Talmud page also, which is just before the page that you're looking at, okay? So if you flip it over before, that's a traditional page of Talmud. For those of you who are not familiar with the Talmud, the Talmud is in the middle and the commentaries are around the sides. Okay? So let's just look. We'll look at the art scroll with a translation. Shiv'a k'nei menorah. You know the menorah that is discussed in the book of Exodus when there is the construction of a tabernacle. In that tabernacle will be a seven-branched menorah. What if one of the branches is damaged? Is the menorah still usable? That's the question. Me'akvin ze et ze. Me'akvin, translated here, are essential to one another. The seven branches are essential to one another. That's not actually what me'akvin means. It actually means the opposite of are essential. It means disqualify. So in other words, does one branch disqualify all the rest? Or could you still use the menorah? In fact, it's me'akvin ze means that they disqualify one another. So if you do not have all seven branches, you don't have a menorah at all. You can't use it. All right? Shiv'a nerotah me'akvin ze. In the menorah, which is pictured on the page here, at the top, you have lamps. Seven lamps are placed at the top. What if one of those lamps is damaged, doesn't work, or is not lit, or whatever? That disqualifies all the rest. You have to have a complete menorah. It has to be totally complete. Now, Vincenza. Okay. Shtei parashiyot shebemezuzah me'avot zo et zo. Two parshas in the mezuzah disqualify each other. In other words, what is in a mezuzah? There are two paragraphs of the Torah that are in a mezuzah. Now take this page, the top page, and you'll see the inside of the mezuzah. First of all, mezuzah does not mean the structure, the physical structure on the outside. When the Talmud speaks about a mezuzah, that's irrelevant. You can have a mezuzah in anything, so totally irrelevant. Even though most people these days talk about a mezuzah, that physical thing that's on the outside. I sometimes wonder when I see all these mezuzahs that are around whether there's anything on the inside. Or whether people just don't know there's supposed to be something on the inside. The whole mezuzah is on the inside, not on the outside. Okay? On the inside is a piece of parchment. And on that piece of parchment are written by hand two paragraphs of the Torah. Two paragraphs from the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 to 9. That paragraph begins, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha, and so on. And you know the end of that paragraph, it says, Ukshartam la'ot al yadecha, you shall bind them for a sign upon your hands, Ukhtavtam al mezuzot beitecha v'sharecha, and you shall write them upon the doorposts of your house and upon your gates. Okay? That is the commandment to have a mezuzah on the door. Now that is in that first paragraph of the Shema. Second paragraph is Deuteronomy 11, chapter 11, verses 13 to 21, from Parashat Ekev. And that is the second paragraph of the Shema. Now the Shema contains three paragraphs. First one starts with Shema Yisrael, continues, and it's right from the Torah, V'ahavta, and goes as far as V'sharecha, on your gates. The second paragraph of the Shema begins, V'haya im shamoa tishmu'u el mitzotai. Okay? And it shall be that if you listen to my commandments, which I command you this day, and so on. And down toward the end of that paragraph, it says, you shall teach them to your children, to speak of them when you lie down and when you rise up. Uchtavtam al mezuzot beitecha. And you shall write them al mezuzot, on the mezuzot of your house. Now, mezuzot probably means they're the doorposts. Those are the doorposts of your house. So you have to write this on the doorposts of your house. Some of you may have seen, in my other hometown of Jerusalem, actually was accustomed for a while on the doorposts to write Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad in big Hebrew letters. There was a past that happened, and that's not according to the halakha, that's not law, but people were doing it for a while. What you are required to do is to have these two paragraphs of the Shema on a piece of parchment, okay? First one is Shema Yisrael. Second one is V'haya im Shema Tishma'u. And that constitutes what we call the mezuzah. That constitutes the mezuzah. Okay? I said there are two paragraphs. But the Mishnah is asking, what if you leave off one paragraph? Okay? Or if it's damaged? If it's damaged, what happens then? Okay? Not kosher. Okay? Now let's see what it says in fact. Let's look here. It says, Shtei parashiyot shebemezuzah, the two parashas, namely, Shema Yisrael and Vayayim Shamoa, those two paragraphs, they are me'akvot zo et zo. They disqualify one another. That is to say, if there's a problem with one, the other is not worth a nickel for your mezuzah. Okay? Now look how this continues. It says, afilu ketav echad me'akvan. Even one letter disqualifies. Even one letter disqualifies. I'll go on now. Arba parashiyot shebitfilin ma'akvim zo et zo. The four paragraphs in the tefillin disqualify each other. Afilu ketav echad me'akvan. Even one letter disqualifies it. Even one letter disqualifies it. Okay? Arba tzitziot ma'akvot zo et zo. The four tzitzit on the talit disqualify one another. That is to say, if you have only three tzitzit on your talit, do you have a talit? You don't have anything. It's not worth anything. Okay? It's totally invalid. Totally invalid. Are you with me so far? Okay, so you see the concept here. This concept grew out of grain offerings. Would you believe it? We started with grain offerings. We were dealing with frankincense and olive oil and flour. And here we have moved laterally to discuss the smaller part, the smaller issues involved in more complex issues. Okay, and that's basically the Talmud's interest. Let me take your questions still here. Any questions that you have so far? Yes, Bobby.
Well, it would seem as though they're giving us a very clear principle that everything has to be perfect. One thing, even one letter, and it negates the whole thing.
I'll take that as true, as long as you're willing to say that everything doesn't mean everything.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Couldn't we too use this as principle that we apply to most situations?
That's the question. Is this something that is a principle that we could apply to most situations? Or is it determined for these specific things and for them alone? Okay? Now that's a question that's just an abstract question. Generally speaking, the Talmud will try to always base itself on scriptural reasons. Usually try to do that. Not always. Sometimes it will base itself on intuition and logic. Okay? So you're picking up on a logical side, which certainly makes a lot of sense. But even then you'll wonder, how far can we really extend this? Because we probably wouldn't want to take it too far, even if we liked the idea. Any other questions here?
I think the issue is how essential it is to preserve the text. That's what I think they're afraid of.
Uh-huh. Okay. Herb says the real question here is how essential is it to preserve the text itself?
That's right.
Okay.
So the same thing with the Torah. It has to be, no letter can be wrong in a safer Torah. It has to be, the text has to be preserved over the...
Now, Herb brings up a very interesting fact, which those of you who have been around in Or Zarua long enough have probably seen. Every once in a while, when we're reading the Torah, we find there's a mistake in the Torah.
Alan,
I was reading it 2 years ago, and there was a vav missing, and I noticed it wasn't erased. It was the Sofer had never even written it in the first place.
Okay. So there was a case.
It was just one letter.
Where you have a vav, and the truth is, sometimes you can make an O or an U sound without having a vav. Because you know in a written text, it's just a dot in a pointed text. But the Torah has no pointing in it, so it leaves out all of the vowels. Sometimes it's written what's called malay. Malay means full, namely you put the letter there of the vav, and you know that it's an O or an U sound. Sometimes it's written chaser, without that, and you just have to know that there would be a dot there, okay? Now, there are strict rules about that. Every Torah has to be written the same way. You found the case where the Sofer left out the vav.
This was the vav at the beginning of the word.
Oh, it was above it at the beginning.
Ahavta. Yeah.
Okay.
It wasn't in the middle of the word.
Very interesting. Okay, so it had a different meaning. It meant end there. And the Sofer just left it out. It happens. It happens. Now, what did you do with the Sefer Torah at that point?
Right. Rabbi Bolton had us, we closed the Torah. We didn't do a regular hagba. We put the cover on and we wrapped the rope around the outside.
Because it's disqualified. It's no longer a Sefer Torah. At that point, it's no longer to be dealt with as a Sefer Torah, although, of course, it's almost a Sefer Torah, so you can't just do anything with it. But you have to watch out for it, and you have to take it to be repaired. Okay? Once it's repaired, what do you do with it?
It's used again.
Now that may seem obvious, but you just wait. You just wait.
What was important, it was the lightest Torah for those of the do Hagba. It was the lightest of our Torahs.
On Saturday, one of the handles broke off.
Right. Okay, that's an interesting idea. Okay, so this is very interesting. Let's take that for a moment. This past Saturday, one of the handles broke off the Sefer Torah. According to Bobby's principle, right, you are beginning to abstract that the thing's got to be perfect.
No, that's okay. Ornamental. That's if the flower was broken off of this menorah.
Oh, that was, so you're saying, Eric, that that was ornamental. How do you know that that's ornamental?
Well, the Mishnah here says if one of the lamps is broken. It doesn't say if the flower is broken on the bottom by the base, that the whole menorah is disqualified.
True, that is true. But so let's just see. For example, if it says that...
This is not a test.
If it says, for example, that one letter... We just read this here in the Mishnah. One letter disqualifies. Let me ask you, what is a letter? What is a letter? Is a letter that you could read? Is a letter that is that a child could read, let's say, who's less used to reading than an adult is? Is a letter something that's written perfectly? Because a letter in the Torah should be written perfectly. And what if it's only two-thirds of the letter? But when you read it, you kind of know what it's supposed to say anyway. So I'm just asking, what is the definition of a letter here? Okay, it's not so simple. Not so simple. Okay? Yes?
I just want to know how we get from the letters to the decoration.
From the letters to the decoration. Okay. Have patience. Okay. We'll take that one step at a time. Now, yes, Robert.
I think a couple of years ago, and I'm embarrassed, I don't remember what Masech we were studying, came up the subject of what can you do when you have a fire on Shabbat to take things out.
Last year.
So we have a discussion there about there's a Torah inside, whether it's a big Knesset or how many letters?
81.
81 letters, you have to go in and rescue it. So it's missing 99% of the letters, and still... From that point of view, it's Torah.
Correct. But you couldn't read it. You couldn't read it in the synagogue.
You need to save it, but you cannot read it.
Correct. You need to save it, but you cannot read it. Correct. Okay.
You can't so with contempt.
No, that's right. No, I tried to say that, you know, that it's not just anything, but it's not enough of a Torah that you could actually read it. Okay? Yeah.
So then... two questions. One is to pick up on Diane's question. This is the Torah, isn't it the scroll itself, the parchment, the letters? Is it qualified as a Torah once it's put on Beis Chaim, or can you read it without Beis Chaim? Is it still a proper Torah? Second question, if I may, is when you start out by saying the Mishnah presented information that at a certain point no longer was relevant because we weren't doing doing sacrifices, and so why is the Mishnah important at all? And one might say because it's important to know what used to be that isn't.
Sure, definitely. Couldn't agree more.
Right, so the first question about go back to the Torah. Is it still a holy Torah?
Well, did you ever see a Sephardi Torah?
In this case, yeah.
A Sephardi Torah is a completely different Torah. It doesn't have that kind of structure. And the Sephardim read it every day. it's certainly a kosher Torah.
Well, if the outside of a mezuzah doesn't matter, correct. Then the outside of a Torah should matter.
Correct. Okay.
The issue with this, though, is that it's not possible to roll it correctly with that broken on the top piece.
But does that disqualify us from reading it?
No, but it needs to be repaired.
Oh, it needs to be repaired.
In order to continue doing it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, to roll it,
to roll, but it's broken on the top.
It's broken off completely.
Correct. So yes. You can roll it from the bottom. I'm being a devil's advocate here.
Yeah,
I'm just trying to press these things. Okay.
It has already been taken.
Excellent. That's very good. Now, in the Talmud itself, I'm going on the Talmud page, which is not the Art Scroll page, but the page that came just before it. I said to you that the Talmud text is in the center of the page, and the commentary is around the side of the page. Okay? So, if you can see in the center of the page, there's a big Mem Tav Nun Yud. Mem Tav Nun Yud. That's Matnita, which is the Aramaic word for Mishnah. So the Mishnah that we just read is right there. Excuse me. If you go to the right, just one column to the right of the Talmud text, is the Rashi commentary. Rashi's commentary. Rashi, 1040 to 1105, French commentator. Rashi is always on the inner margin of any printed Talmud page. That's the convention that's used for Rashi. Rashi's the inner margin of any Talmud page. Not necessarily the very inner margin, but the inner margin in relation to the Talmud text itself. Okay? So I want to look at the Rashi, because Rashi will explain many of the things in the Talmud text in a very succinct fashion. If you see in Rashi, about almost halfway down the page in Rashi, there's also a big Mem Tav Nun Yud. So that's where he begins to comment on the Mishnah. First one is Shiva Kneya Menorah. Let's skip that. Go down to the next one. It says Shtei Parshiot Shabamezuzah. Do you see that? Shtei Parshiot Shabamezuzah. Here he just comments to tell you what I told you before. The two parshas in the mezuzah are Shema. That's paragraph one. And Vahaya Im Shamoa. That's paragraph two. Okay? Now, Rashi's next comment is on Ketav Echad. Remember it said, even one Ketav, even one letter. I translated it, and the Art Scroll translated it as letter. Do you know what? Ketav doesn't mean letter. What does Ketav mean?
Writing.
It really means one writing. So it may mean a letter, or may not mean a letter. Art Scroll is at least at this... It could mean a stroke. Maybe it's not a stroke. Okay. Right. Ketav Echad. And look what Rashi says. Ot Achat. So he defines it as one letter. One letter. Me'akvin. One letter disqualifies. So if you have one letter that is a mistake in the mezuzah, it's disqualified. Me'akvin zo et zo. It's disqualifies the whole rest of it. Dichtiv. And here he quotes the first paragraph and the second paragraph of the Shema, which are both in the mezuzah, as it is written. Uchtavtam. Uchtavtam. And you shall write them. Okay? Now, let me get up here. See if there's... And you shall write them. It's a complex Hebrew word. It actually has three English words in it. Kaftav is write, and it has four English words in it. U is end. Kaftav is write. The taf indicates you, and the men indicates them. Okay? So, and you shall write them. Ush, and you shall write them. Simple, well, not simple, but basic Hebrew. That's very basic Torah Hebrew. Rashi now points out, it says, uchataftam. The katav
has to be Tom. What does Tom mean in Hebrew?
It's faithful.
Purely. It has to be perfect. Something that is Tom or Tamim is perfect. It's perfect. Okay? So from this word in the text, that word is two words if you read it slightly differently. And because of that, then, we learn that the katab, the writing, has to be perfect. It has to be complete. Okay? Now, it says that about a mezuzah. Does it say that about a Sefer Torah?
No.
Interestingly, it doesn't. It doesn't say that about a Sefer Torah. How about a mezuzah? How about a mezuzah? I don't know if it's a tefillin. How about the tefillin? In fact, it doesn't say that about the tefillin either. But as far as the tefillin goes, it says about tefillin in the Torah, the ha'yu letotafot ben enecha. The ha'yu, whoops, the ha'yu, the ha'yu. They shall be for frontlets between your eyes. V'hayu is Vav, He, Yud, Vav. Interestingly enough, Vav, He, Yud, Ve. Close to the divine name. Not exactly. Close. Contains the word being in Hebrew. You know, Hebrew doesn't have a present tense for being. There is no word for is in Hebrew. There's no word for is. But this is indicative of the state of being, behayu. And they shall be, the future tense, they shall be for frontlets between your eyes. According to Rashi, coming up now, the fact that this says behayu means that this is true. As far as the tefillin goes, the tefillin has a certain permanence of being to it. There's a certain permanence of being. That's the tefillin. And therefore, tefillin also fall under the category of being uchetavtav. Because it says, V'hayu letotafot eneinecha. Because of the specific language that is used. Now let us say, you're a sofer. And you're writing a mezuzah, okay? And you make a mistake two-thirds of the way down. Let's say you were a sofer writing a Sefer Torah. You made a mistake. What would you do?
You would try to fix it.
Okay? If you're writing a Sefer Torah. If you're writing a mezuzah, can you fix it? that it's harder practical. To fix because it's so little. I'm going to show you a typical mezuzah cloth in just a moment. All right? It's harder, you're right. But there's a much bigger problem than that. The problem is, uchetavtav, you shall write perfectly. If you make a mistake in a mezuzah, it's totally disqualified. You cannot correct it. Can I go
ahead? So you
think
do you think that came out of how hard it was to write cuneiform and that you couldn't easily...
I couldn't tell you. I'm not the slightest idea. I don't know. All I know is that as far as the Talmud is concerned, it comes out of uchetavtav. It comes out of the specific language of the text itself. And therefore, you cannot... In a mezuzah, you cannot correct a mezuzah. That's why it's very hard to be a sofer. Not so hard to write Sefer Torah because you can always make a mistake and correct it. But you can lose a lot of time. And as you said correctly, it's very small writing, so it takes a long time to do. And it's not hard to imagine that you can make a mistake. You make a mistake, not worth a nickel. Okay, you can't sell it for anything. It's just totally small.
How did he get, I didn't get the Tom,
the Ketuv Tum, that's a suffix. I mean, it's a grammatical, it's part of the grammar.
Right.
And Tum is, Ketuv Tum is a suffix.
That's what you say it's a suffix.
But, I mean, how did he jump from the grammar to something else?
How did he jump from grammar to something? That is why I have entitled these lectures The Mystery of Sacred Script. Because once something is sacred, in fact, one thing alone, for example, the use of grammar is but one way to read the text. Once something is sacred, as in a fantastic painting, there isn't one interpretation of a great painting. There are many interpretations of a great painting. A great piece of literature has one interpretation. We are used to the simple reading of texts because of the world in which we live. We want to read things in a straightforward and obviously not, obviously intuitive fashion. There may, however, be a completely different way of reading it. And in fact, you see, to begin with, that this is what the rabbis are doing. They understand the simple reading of the text. But a sacred text offers additional possibilities in comprehending what it is. Not only possibilities, you may find, as is the case here, that the law will come from the non-intuitive way of reading the text. It will come from the more mystical, I'll use that term mystical, or even though it's not Kabbalah here, but it will come from that reading of the text, and that will govern the way, in fact, the Sofer prepares his thesis. Additional questions?
Well, since the Torah starts with a word, spoken word, and every morning we read the section about his word is performance. The word really counts. I'll just give an anecdote. Probably the worst experience of my entire educational career was in high school, because I had a Spanish teacher who didn't let you cross out on your tests. If it was crossed out, it was wrong. So you had to have this incredible intensity of thinking and getting your hand to do it exactly right the first time. Terrorizing.
I can imagine that was a terrible experience. That must have been a terrible experience.
You read the Torah all the time, right? Every day, three times a week, whatever, whenever. Mm-hmm. You never read Tefillin, you never read the Mezuzah. The implication is that it has some intrinsic, we don't wear it to read it, so it has some intrinsic sanctity.
That's true. That's quite correct.
You better understand the Torah because you're looking at it all.
Uh-huh.
It can't be messed up.
So you are reading you're reading the content of the Mezuzah because you're reading the Shema. Right? And the Shema has those two paragraphs that are in the Mezuzah. So you read that content, but you're quite right. In fact, you don't read this. In fact, it is something that goes beyond. It really goes beyond what it says. It becomes a sacred document. It is a sacred document. And therefore, its sanctity also is catching. It's catching. There's something about it. When people will often walk in a door, in my neighborhood in Jerusalem, nobody walks through the door without putting a hand up to the mezuzah. They go up to the mezuzah, they touch the mezuzah, and they kiss the mezuzah. Okay? It's very common practice. Very common practice. Why? Because there's an aura of sanctity about the whole thing.
Just thinking of that martyr, I don't remember which time in history it was, who was burned holding the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Torah pages burned up, but the letters.
Okay. Thank you. You're going where I'm going. We're going to the same place. We're going to the same place. Now, I want to send around a piece of parchment that is a disqualified mezuzah. It's an old mezuzah that I had, and eventually it fell apart, so it can't use this inner mezuzah anymore. It's torn. And I want you, as it goes around, to take a look at a few things, and it will just concretize what you've got in front of you here on the Xerox sheet. And that is, first of all, look at the very tiny letters. The letters are extremely small. The laws of the mezuzah is written in a number of lines, and those lines are fixed, in fact. The first letter, the first words of those lines are fixed. It's always got to be the same. Just as you look at this, look at the fact that there's a large ayin and a large dalet, which is in the same as in a Sefer Torah. When you read Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad, has a large ayin and a large dalet. The ayin of Shema is large, and the dalet is large at the end. Jews who know how to pronounce an ayin actually make a point of pronouncing the ayin and the dalet. Those of us who don't pronounce the... most Ashkenazim can't pronounce an ayin. I can try, but sound foolish. A good North African or Middle Eastern Jew, your family, your wife's family, they could do it. Shema is not Shema. It's not an ayin. It's not a silent letter. It's pronounced. It's Shema. You didn't hear that? Shema. Some kind of choking sound, which Jews from the Middle East know how to do. We make an issue of pronouncing the dalet at the end. The dalet. Shema Yisrael Hashem Hashem Echad. We pronounce the dalet. And the ayin and the dalet are large in the text. They are pronounced because an ayin and a dalet is a witness. An aid. And the recitation of the Shema is bearing witness. You are bearing witness to the divine presence that there is a God in the world. That's why you have a large ayin and a large dalet. Okay? The script itself conveys additional meanings. Now, when you look at this, also look at the back of it. Because I don't know how many of you have ever examined the mezuzot that you may have on your doors. And one of the odd things is that there's writing on the back as well. Writing on the back. So I want you to see that, because I'm going to talk about that in a moment, what's on the back of a mezuzah. You have here the word Shaddai. Shaddai. Sometimes I'll see that the cases of the mezuzot are made with the letter Shaddai. That's emphasized. And Shaddai, what does Shaddai mean?
God.
The name of God, right?
Yeah.
However.
It means breast.
It means what?
Breast.
A Shaddai is interesting. It also means breast. That's correct. But in the mezuzah, the presence of that word on the back, Shaddai, that is there because it is an acronym. And that comes from the Zohar. The Zohar is the 12th century. And the Zohar says that there should be the letters Shin, Dalet, and Yud, because that's an acronym for Shomer Daltot Yisrael. He guards the doors of Israel. He guards the doors of Israel. Okay? And if you look at where it appears on this side. That's because when you roll up the mezuzah, you start on the far end, on the left side, you roll it up like this, and then what's left on the outside is Shaddai. Okay? See that? Shaddai is left on the outside. It is, however, across from the second of the paragraphs. Notice it's lower down?
Yeah.
It's halfway down? You can see this on the page that I gave to you. Okay? See? Shaddai where it is? It's halfway down. Halfway down. If it's halfway down, realize what it is opposite. It's opposite the second paragraph and not the first paragraph of the Shema. Okay? Opposite the second paragraph of the Shema. Now, the Zohar says it has to be there opposite the second paragraph for the following reason. What is the first word of the second paragraph of the Shema? Vehaya. Vehaya. Okay? The letters of Vehaya, the letters of Vehaya are the same letters as in the divine name, Yud He Vav He. Yud He Vav He. In order to make it clear that on both sides of the parchment you have Shomer Daltot Yisrael, he is guarding the doors of Israel, that is next to the second paragraph, so that we realize when we see Vihaya that it doesn't mean only what we think it means, and it shall be. But rather, we will be reminded that it contains the letters of the divine name. Okay? So even the word Vihaya, even though you're right grammatically, it means shall be. The mezuzah doesn't want us to only think it'll be shall be, but it wants us to remember the divine name. Okay? Now if you think that's odd, you ain't seen nothing yet. On the outside of the mezuzah, okay, on the outside of the klafia, and I gave it to you on the one that I photographed, there is a series of Hebrew letters that are upside down. Okay? If you turn them over, okay? Oh, no, before I get to that, hold on to that a second. Just remember something else. Mezuzah. What is the gematria of mezuzah? Gematria, there's a numerical value to every Hebrew letter. Okay? Who can do gematrias fast?
64.
Try again.
Mezuzah.
Mem.
40.
Mem is 40. Zion.
7.
Is 47. Vav is 6. 53. Okay. Zion. 60. 60. Then Hay is 5. So 65. It's 65. Okay. What is the numerical value of Adonai? Adonai. Aleph? 1. Dalet? 4. It's got 5. Okay. Nun? 50. Yud? 65. Okay? So the mezuzah has the same numerical value as Adonai. Okay? Now, back to that strange Hebrew writing here. Okay? Strange Hebrew writing. The writing says, Kuzu, b'muchsaz kuzu. Kuzu, b'muchsaz kuzu. Herb, you know Hebrew. What does kuzu, b'muchsaz kuzu mean?
Much,
Mukhtar must be something to do with writing.
You're trying too hard.
Look,
the truth is, it's nothing. It's weird. It's a code. It's a code. Right? Let me tell you how to break the code. The code is on the mezuzah, on kuzu b'muchsaz kuzu. This is a code where every Hebrew letter is written. Instead of writing the correct letter, you write the next letter in the alphabet.
Common code.
Do you ever speak pidgin English? All right.
It's here. A very common code.
Okay, this is a code. All right, so kaf, go one letter back in the alphabet.
Yud.
Is a yud. Vav, go one letter back, is a hey. Zion is a vav. Vav is a hey. So far we have yud, hey, vav, hey. What's that? That's the divine name. That's the divine name. Okay? Okay? B'muchsas. Bet, go back, is an aleph. Mem, is a lamed. Vav, is a hey. Chaf, is a yud. Samech, is a nun. Zion, is a vav. Eloheinu. That's Eloheinu.
The third is the same as the first.
Okay. And then the third one is the same as the first. So we have here Hashem Elokeinu Hashem. If you look at this, you will see that this, the Muchsu, is opposite the first paragraph of the Shema. Because the first paragraph says, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu Adonai. This is now Adonai Eloheinu Adonai, but in Muchsu. Okay? I'm going to send this around. You can take a look at it.
Why is it when was all this developed?
What?
And why is it called this? Why skip a letter?
This was developed over a long period of time. The Kuzu B'Muchsu Kuzu is not in the Talmud, and it is not in the Zohar. It is not necessarily in Sfardi mezuzot. It was customary and is customary today in all Ashkenazi mezuzot. All Ashkenazi mezuzot. At some point, this became customary in the European Jewish communities. Okay? It was obviously a Kabbalistic way of thinking. Right? It was seeing everything in code language and wanting to also create, and it's almost an artistry to it. It's almost an artistry to it. Notice that it's upside down. Why would it be upside down? Because it really isn't a halachic part of the mezuzah. It's not really appropriate on the mezuzah. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef asks whether Sfardin in their mezuzot should put in kuzu b'muchsu kuzu. And he says, it has become a tradition, number one. Maimonides, in his Laws of the Mezuzah, rails against the use of the mezuzah as an amulet. He says there are people who will try to use the mezuzah, and Maimonides can't stand superstition. He clearly forbids it. So then Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, who just died 2 years ago, Ovadia Yosef says, is this therefore prohibited? And he says, no, it's not prohibited because it's on the outside of the mezuzah, not on the inside. When Maimonides said what he said it as far as the inside goes, but not as far as the outside goes. But you can see the way in which just almost the aesthetics of the thing have created something that in a way has, you know, it has reverberations once you know what the code is, and it's right opposite the first paragraph of the Shema. Yet, on the other hand, it's clearly diminished in significance. It's upside down. It's upside down. Questions here?
That's right.
So you mentioned that the die is so small so they cannot fix the letter, then it would be no problem.
No, no, I didn't say that. I said that you cannot fix the letters because it says uchetavta. That's why you're not. The fact is, someone might say it's too small, but that's not the reason. The reason is because it says uchetavta.
Even if I would have a big mezuzah?
You could have a mezuzah on the side of this room. By the Kotel, for example, on Shar HaAshpot in Jerusalem, there's a huge mezuzah like this. It's a huge mezuzah. Enormous. I never saw such a big mezuzah.
How big is the door?
Oh, I mean, it's 20 feet tall. It's huge. It's huge.
They also don't use, often in Israel, they don't use a box. It's carved into the wall.
Sometimes it's carved. They actually put it into the wall. Correct. They just carve out a hole in the wall and put it right in the wall. Because you don't need it. You don't really need the external casing for it, the case.
Are there other examples of this code? Mm-hmm. In
sure.
Religion?
Oh, yeah. We just haven't dealt with them before.
Is the same code or different codes?
Different codes. Different codes. I'll give you another, just to tip you off about one. It's not in the... it's not in our Sim Shalom Sidur. Those of you who will use... we'll use the other one, the Koran. The Friday night service, there is a prayer right before Lechadodi. Just before Lechadodi. What is it? Anna Becholach. Thank you. Anna Becholach. Anna Becholach is also in code. It's a code. It's a mystical code. And nobody knows that, because we know that everybody reads on the Makoah, it has melodies and so on. It's essentially a mystical code. It's right in the prayer book itself. Right in the prayer book itself. Okay? All right. Yes?
The notion of the amulet certainly hasn't died. I'm in the middle of reading the book Rebbe by Rabbi Telushkin,
mm-hmm.
about Rabbi Schneerson, and one of... I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but one of the places where he was most heavily criticized is, I think, after 9/11, the Rebbe recommended going and checking the mezuzahs to see whether or not they're kosher as an explanation for why something bad happened. And uh-huh. I think when people become sick, it's still a tradition to check the mezuzah. So is that... That strain seems to have...
It is always a danger. It is always a danger, which is why Maimonides comes out so strongly. Because it's always a potential danger, correct? When I was growing up, for example, you didn't have mezuzot on the houses the way you do today. Jews were very self-conscious about making a public statement about the fact that they were Jewish. And they may have moved into a neighborhood where they were the first Jewish family. The last thing they wanted to do was put something on their doorposts. And instead, what was very common when I was a young man was for people to wear mezuzot around their necks. Okay, here you go.
And it has a parchment, and it has a whole
cut. Okay, that's... That has nothing in the least to do with a mezuzah. Nothing to do with a mezuzah. That is the kind of thing that just developed, and it develops at certain points in time, but it's not the mezuzah. The mezuzah is very specific what's supposed to happen to it. Even interestingly enough, and this was an issue when we built this building, a synagogue is not obligated to have a mezuzah. You know that? A synagogue is not obligated to have a mezuzah. It has become a custom, but there are synagogues you'll go into, classic synagogues that do not have mezuzot, because it says, Uchtatam al mezuzot beitecha uvisharecha. Where it says beitecha, it's a place that you inhabit, where you live. It became customary in the European synagogues because people would often lodge in the synagogues. They would actually lodge there. Travelers would be traveling from town to town. Synagogue would have dormitory space. that point, synagogues began to have mezuzot on them. Ancient synagogues don't have mezuzot. They don't have them because it's a religious space and not a place of habitation. All right? Yes?
We don't put a mezuzah on the sukkah, which is...
Great, because it's a temporary dwelling.
Even though we dwell
there. Correct. Even though we dwell there, it has to be a permanent dwelling. As a matter of fact, if you move into an apartment on the Upper East Side, you cannot put on your mezuzah until 30 days have passed. You know why? But if you move into an apartment in the land of Israel, you have to put it on immediately. Because if you're in the diaspora, you still might make aliyah. We should never think of our dwelling in a diaspora as permanent. Right? It's not permanent. Therefore, you don't put a mezuzah on the door till 30 days have passed. And in Israel, you do. You put on immediately.
What about a sukkah in Israel?
Same thing. It's a temporary dwelling. You don't put a mezuzah on it. It has to be a permanent dwelling.
What about paper versus parchment?
A paper mezuzah is totally invalid. Totally invalid. It has to be on parchment, a certain kind of parchment, and it has to be written properly by hand. You cannot have a photocopied mezuzah text.
The Shaddai on the mezuzah, does that tie in any way with Shaddai we have with the tefillin, where the knots of the tefillin spell out Shaddai?
Yes and no. It's the real question is the knots on the tefillin. Whether that really has anything to do with Shaddai, or whether this is custom that has sort of grown up over the years. Yes.
But aren't you supposed to check the parchment in your mezuzos like every 7 years?
Correct. Should be
checked.
Oh, well, yes, and the tefillin is different.
Really?
Yeah, tefillin is different because the tefillin are not exposed to the weather.
Mm-hmm. Well, what if you live in an apartment?
What, your tefillin?
No, oh, for the mezuzah.
Correct. I have not checked my mezuzot on my doors because we live in the apartment. Yeah, to see whether the parchment has decomposed, deteriorated. Realize when you write on parchment, parchment doesn't absorb the way paper does. You can see that on the Sefer Torah. And the Sefer Torah is very interesting to see. It sits just on top of it. It sits on top of it. It doesn't go into it. Maybe it goes in a little bit, but that's why it can chip off. Now, the Sefer Torah, you're always worried about that the script will chip off because it doesn't necessarily go into the parchment itself. Okay? Yes, sir.
So the last time I bought mezuzahs, I went to that store on Lexington, Dornach. I bought two structures and two scrolls.
Okay.
And I put them up, but I didn't open it. I didn't... are you supposed to check it?
No, you don't have to check it because the assumption is that they've checked it.
Yeah. Okay.
The self has checked it. Okay. So you don't have to do it yourself. Yeah.
But you need to take it from the plastic. It comes in.
No, you don't have to take it from the plastic.
The plastic.
You can keep it with the plastic. Correct. That's an interesting point. You can keep it with the plastic because it can protect it. It can protect it.
But it shouldn't be open to the air.
It doesn't have to be open to the air. Remember what we said. The key thing is that you've got the correctly written piece of parchment. It doesn't matter what's around it. You don't even need any casing for it. You can just stick it right in a hole in the doorpost. Okay? It's come to be our custom to have a casing for it. Now, I'll give you, since we're coming close to the end of our time, I'll just give you one or two other pointers about your mezuzah. When you put up a mezuzah, what direction is it supposed to go in?
The top should be facing in.
Diagonally facing in. What if it goes straight up?
No.
It's kosher.
It is.
Matter of fact...
There's no room to put an angle on our doorpost.
Correct. You may have a doorpost. I have at least one of these in my house where you don't have enough room to put it at 45 degrees. And you have to put it either straight up or nearly straight up. Perfectly kosher. Perfectly kosher. As a matter of fact, there are two different points of view in the Talmud. One point of view says that it should be straight up. The other point of view says it should be horizontal. And therefore, the Tosafot, the medieval commentators in Ashkenaz, in France, decided that instead of making it up or like this, you go 50% right in the middle at a 45 degree angle. And that's why we Ashkenazim have the custom of putting it at a 45 degree angle, because that was the French interpretation, and we follow the French customs. We follow the Ashkenazi customs.
So there are other countries where they're in different directions?
Oh, my building in Jerusalem, the Sephardim, some of the Sephardim put it straight up.
Nobody goes this way.
I had never seen it, but realize it's just not practical, by and large. Although on a larger doorpost, it could be practical. Okay? I saw another hand. Yes, ma'am?
Is there any validity to what may have been a minhag, that if you are moving out of a home or an apartment, if you know that a Jew is moving in,
you can't remove the mezuzah.
Leave the mezuzah.
Correct.
If you don't know, you can take it off.
Correct. If you don't know, if you know that a Jew is moving into your apartment, you're not supposed to remove the mezuzah.
Is it only the outside mezuzah or every room?
All the mezuzah. All the mezuzahs.
All of them.
All the mezuzahs.
You're supposed to leave a mezuzah.
It doesn't have to be your gold case mezuzah.
Correct.
All right?
Correct.
You can put up other cases.
You can put up... The cases are irrelevant to the whole thing.
We have to sell to a non-Jew.
Ladies and gentlemen, to be continued.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi. And they've got a in their custom number. Wow. Must be a charcoal or black paint on the top of their door. So if you look at the doorpost, I don't know.